Funny Bone, the game for people who love to laugh.
The shin bone connected to the knee bone. The ear bone connected to the shoulder bone. The hip bone connected to the hand bone. The head bone connected to the...
Roll for host.
Roll for host.
20.
Oh my god.
That doesn't count.
The mythical. Doesn't? Yeah, that doesn't count. It's got to be in the tray.
Oh shit!
Oh, 220 is a 20.
God damn it! The first time I ever roll a 20.
Of course.
And Mike has to match
Dude,
it.
Don't mess with the 20 master. All right.
Okay, 20 off.
20 off.
Oh, nope, fired
doesn't
it.
Count.
Literally off.
Jesus
oh,
Christ.
God.
Yes.
Mike rolled
another
20.
Another 20.
And right, Charles did seven. Not.
Oh, my God.
That was two in
wow.
a row.
It is a magical day, that folks.
Ridiculous.
Magical incredible. Day. Welcome to the Escort Mission Podcast.
Mike was really fucking meant to host today.
I just got two 20s in a row. I don't even know what to say at this point. This is the awesome podcast. We talk about games and news and tech and cool stuff. Today, we've got a special guest on the show. John, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Awesome. Thank
First
you.
First returning guest? First returning
yeah,
guest?
Yeah, returning.
Yeah. Okay. Definitely returning.
All right.
John, our first returning guest.
No, Robin's returned.
Robin's been Robin's on it twice. Yeah.
Justin's
Justin.
Returned.
Anyway.
Okay. Nothing
welcome.
Special about that then.
Oh, man.
But those other voices you hear are Chaz.
Hello.
And John, Josh.
What's up?
Cool. So, John is visiting this weekend. That means we played board games.
Exclusively for 48 hours at a stroke.
Well, they did, but I also went to Disneyland and DCA, so that's cool, too.
I feel like I'm at 72 hours already. How long have you been playing?
We've been playing board games and sleeping.
Since Friday.
Since Friday at noon.
It is Sunday morning.
Yes.
The Rare Morning Podcast.
Right.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, two days straight for me, yep.
Mm-hmm.
So before we get into board games, I just want to mention, like I said, I am the only one here who actually went to Disneyland and DCA yesterday. It was my first DCA visit.
And I am the only one that went to Comic-Con last weekend.
Right, and we'll get to that, but I'm hosting, so I'm doing my shit first. So Disney California Adventure is like right next door to Disneyland. I haven't been to Disneyland probably 8 or 9 years, never been to DCA. I think I like DCA better. So they've got two... rides that I went on that are cool. They've got the Screamin', California Screamin', which is like their, you know, roller coaster. It's actually pretty good.
Very punny name.
Yes. I would put it up there with you know, something
Wait,
in Magic Mountain.
Just punny sounds like funny, so that's a
it
pun
is
in
itself.
Itself
a pun, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
The meta pun. So it's a pretty cool roller coaster. Goes upside down one time. It starts off neat. Unlike most roller coasters, which, you know, just go up like an incline slowly and then down, you're actually just on a level surface and it counts down from 5 to 1 and then it immediately goes into like full speed and then up an incline and then down again.
Yeah.
So it's a roller coaster.
Well, I don't know. I think that's unique to how a roller coaster begins,
okay.
So it was worth mentioning.
Space Mountain at Euro Disney does that as well.
Oh, it does?
Yeah, they shoot you out of a cannon. Jules Verne style. It's pretty awesome.
Oh, that's sweet. We also went on Space Mountain, of course, which is still awesome. I love that roller coaster.
It's dark.
I've heard that you can go on it. There are occasional times when they run it with the lights on, and that it's incredibly scary and horrific because you can see like all the gantry shit that's around you.
Even in the dark, it's really kind of weird and disorienting because even though you can't see, you can tell that it's super tight. And you're it feels like you're inches away from a structure.
I went in there like around Halloween or something, and they had all these LCD screens with like fire demons breathing at you and shit.
Ooh.
And ghosts or something. I don't know. There's just all kinds of random stuff. And because there were all these colored things, you could see a bit better in the room than you normally could.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't still like lights fully on, but it was a different experience. It was neat.
That's cool. And then also they built... a set piece after the Cars movie from Pixar. So they built Radiator Springs, so you can walk down the street and they have all of the buildings from that movie, and it's really well done. It was actually quite impressive. I mean, Disney in general is really good at building the experience. Not necessarily thrilling rides, but they definitely work hard on the experience to make you feel like you're in the movie, or I don't know. So
have you seen all the Cars, and are you a fan?
I've only seen the first one, and I liked it. Yeah.
And there's a Planes one now.
And there's Planes coming
out. On another podcast, I heard someone relaying a tweet, so this is really meta, but this tweet was, from the makers of Cars, Cars 2, and Planes comes Disney's next smash hit, Shut Up While Your Parents Have Sex.
Nice. But they also have a Cars-related ride where you, unlike Autopia, where you actually drive and, you know, you hit the gas pedal and stuff, this is one where you just sit back. But the beginning of the ride is really cool. It's sort of like a very serene yet epic, hey, driving through California is awesome. It's got a waterfall and a bridge, and eventually you go in and you meet Cars characters, and they work on your car to turn it into a racing car, and then eventually you come out of a gate and you stop for a second, and whoever was in the car behind you eventually comes up and you both stop, and then you both like gun it and race against each other to the end. I think it's rigged based on the two times I went and who won, but I mean, maybe not.
Who won?
Didn't win, and then I won the other car and then my car, you know. I don't know, the left lane always wins, it seems, but I could be wrong.
That'd be super lame if it was just like the left lane always wins.
I don't know, but that kind of seems like what they would do in a ride like that. Although it seems really easy to make it slightly variable every time, but I don't think it is.
Yeah, it totally seems like they would have it go either... Well, your sample size of two clearly is not enough
right.
for us to know.
Yeah, I don't know. But it was a neat little ride. And then we went on a bunch of other stuff. Either it was a long day driving home. That drive home from Anaheim to San Diego is kind of a hassle. And then I kind of crashed while these guys played board games all day. So that was cool.
Nice, Disney.
Any other news?
Disney.
How much are happening? Disney tickets at this point?
Well, ours were free.
Cool.
Because of a friend, so that was really sweet. I think a park hopper that lets you go back and forth is like 120 or something
for
like that.
For one day?
For a one-day pass.
Over 100 God for damn. two.
Yeah,
park
and then
pass.
Parking, of course, is 16. And
I think it's still barely under 100 for a one park pass.
Wow.
So it was a good deal to know that friend who got us in. Thank you.
Sirs.
Any other news going on before we get into the board gaming?
No.
Nope.
I have to, I mean...
Josh did
Comic-Con. Oh, yeah,
stuff.
You did Comic-Con. Tell us about that.
Yes, I mean, that's kind of news. I have to mention that as fast as I can, although I have, like, a list larger than... Anyway, I went to Comic-Con with Charles's pass last week.
Mm-hmm. Which I did not
which
use.
Which he never used. And
this year, I had passes both to E3 and Comic-Con. I didn't use either of them at all.
Jerk.
I know. It's lame. 16-year-old me is really pissed at current me.
So I spent all day there with Dave on a Saturday. I've been there before, like for brief show floor times on a Sunday with somebody's pass or something, just to like look at merch and people and shit and dressed up people. But I did all the panels and stuff this time, and it was really awesome. And actually, I think we should all go and buy a pass or whatever, or go on a Saturday together next year or something, because it was totally worthwhile, unless it was a fluke and we got really lucky. I don't know. So I saw the Xbox panel where they showed a bunch of stuff. Highlights of which, Forza in Prague looks fucking amazing. Like, it looks so goddamn good at 1080p on a huge screen at 60 frames a second. Like, the sunlight coming through the screen, or the windshield, and the reflection of your dashboard in the windshield. You know? Like, the way the sunlight bounces off. Like, in a real car, you see that, and it's, like, almost a little distracting. But in the game, you're just like, oh, my God, it's amazing. It's like the hair in Tomb Raider.
Mm-hmm.
Like, probably kind of distracting, but just looks so awesome. You don't give a shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Anyway, what was news out of that? The news out of that was that Rare, the Kinect Sports people now, they're using the Kinect for you to, like, stand... in front of it and turn your head around for 10 seconds, and it can scan a model of your face in, and then it can attach that face to a character model in the game, and then it can animate it and caricaturize it a little bit.
Wow.
And it can detect your facial expression in real time. So while you're playing some dumb Kinect sports game, your character could look exactly like you automatically without doing like a custom avatar. Just like move your face in front of it for 10 seconds, and then your character looks like you. And then it could be making the same facial expression you're making while you're playing the game, like whether you're frustrated or having a lot of fun or whatever. And the examples they showed, although it was not in real time, it was like theoretical, and they said that it was working. They looked really impressive. It looked awesome.
That's cool.
Although it's, you know, a minor like superficial add-on to some games that where it's relevant, but that was super cool tech. Dead Rising was hilarious because they model all the bones and guts and gore and brains and viscera inside every zombie in the whole open world, right? So it's one of those open world where you're just killing lots of zombies, except when you like, I don't know, slice off part of the skull of a zombie with a machete or something, and this is one of the screenshots they showed. you see where it cut through the flesh, and then you see the layer of bone, and then you see like gray matter. Or if you like throw a chainsaw javelin at a guy
per se, you know, just an example,
just your regular example, and that severs their whole body in half, you see like their rib cage and their guts fall out independently, and their musculature. Like
sounds
like a great game for Charlie, man. You should hook him up.
It felt kind of out of place compared to everything else in a, like, I don't know, a public setting. I was like, I'm okay with reading that on a blog, but surrounded by 300 people in this convention hall listening to this, it was just.
Was he getting a little too excited about this tech?
It was funnily gory. I don't know. People were laughing. Anyway. what else was super interesting? There was a lot of minorly interesting. Then I got to try Fantasia in the Xbox Lounge.
The Harmonix game?
The Harmonix game.
Yeah.
Number one, like, my opinion is not fully valid because there was lag. So I'm not sure if the lag was because of a calibration error. Like, it felt to me like if we were playing Rock Band 3 and I had miscalibrated it by 200 milliseconds and you were forced to do every move like way before you saw it happen on the screen.
Right.
You're like, you see that coming, you try to do it way early, and then you have success, right? Mm-hmm. So it was uncomfortable and weird because of that. And I told her, and she blamed the Kinect, like it was hot in the end of the day. And so I was hoping that she didn't know what she was talking about, but it was theoretically...
Well, that's going to be a really disappointing piece of hardware.
Theoretically, it has lag right now, and they need to work it out before...
TVs that they didn't...
Or the LCD had delay, or they just didn't calibrate. I told her it needed to be calibrated. She said no. But...
Have you played it, ma'am?
Yeah. I honestly hope... That if that's resolved, then it would still be fun.
Yeah.
But as far as I could tell, the level of fun is more like a Child of Eden. Like, most people would think it's worth $20, not $60. You know, like, it's fun for a bit, but it's not a $60 like Dance Central. It's not a Dance Central competitor.
Is that just because the movement is all too abstract and it doesn't?
It's just
kind
of simple. It's kind of arcadey.
You
know what I mean? It's just okay. You're swiping your hands up to the up. To the down, to the left, to the right, like two hands swiping, turn this cube. Okay. You know?
All right, I'm going to put a beat behind that. That's the opening.
You know? Rise actually looks more impressive than I thought, but it's just like an action combat game like Assassin's Creed or something, except without the open world, but with more cutscenes and quick time events. But it looks kind of neat. Tried that. Killer Instinct is Killer Instinct. So the other highlights of the day is we saw a Shifty Look panel where Scott Kurtz, Chris Straub, Zach Wienersmith, and a couple other guys that you would recognize their names. So the Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal guy, the PvP Online guy, the other Penny Arcade guys that aren't Mike and Jerry, or one of the others that does like the cartoons with the PvP guy.
Blamimations and such.
Yeah, they were all doing a panel together for this company called Shifty Look, where they're taking old game IP characters and putting them into like funny cartoons and new funny web games and stuff like that. So they showed these cartoons like Blamimations starring like Dig Dug and Mappy, the mouse, and Mouse Cop. And
that's important.
And the prince from Katamari was like the janitor, you know. He's got like a New Jersey accent, and he's like, you know, asking them if they can if he can clean that up and stuff like that by rolling over it.
Makes sense.
It's really cute. And Zach Wintersmith, the Saturday Morning Breakfast cereal guy, is making like a Dig Dug interactive comic story thing, and that looks really kind of cute and funny. And then we talked to him for a while. He's rad, and then I got him to sign a shirt and stuff.
Sweet.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I saw, so I work downtown. There's a bunch of Comic-Con stuff happening just all over the place. The best piece of merch that I saw was the Dinosaur Comics. You know how Dinosaur Comics, the layout is always the same? It was that on a whiteboard with a whiteboard marker as merch. So you could design your own Dinosaur Comics at all times.
That's cool.
It's pretty awesome.
As soon as you told me, I ordered it online.
Yeah, that's great.
Because I didn't see it there. One of the interesting things about Zach Wintersmith, I don't know if you're as much of a fan of him as I am, because I think SMBC and XKCD are the two best web comics out, is that we asked him like what he does day to day or whatever. He feels like his job is to professionally read books. Like he reads 3 books a week at least. And just stays informed in order to, like, have enough input to create his, couple of comic strips a week. You know what I mean?
He makes a lot of comic strips a week. It's 5 days a week, isn't it?
Every time I go to their website, there's several
I missed.
Yeah.
Unlike Penny Arcade, which I feel he totally pumps out.
His money just off merch? That's how he makes his living, is selling.
And ad sales on the
ad
site.
Ad sales on the site. Yeah, I think the
that's the webcomics model, right?
Yeah.
I think their YouTube thing, the SMBC Theater, I think that gets them some YouTube channel views.
I mean, but there's a lot of webcomics, and I'm sure they try to make a living that way, but still have a day job. So
I would have imagined most.
Yeah, but when you can be him and just make it just off that, that's like you've reached the goal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so because he reached that goal, since he reached that goal, he feels obligated to keep it up, and so his day job is like reading, and then
his job is being interesting enough to write the comic that is relevant.
And his comic is, not just anybody could make that comic. Yeah. It's so involved. And
he basically said he can't be complacent. He has to like not relax. He has to keep himself stressed so that...
Okay, that sounds bad.
To an extent, you know what I mean, in order to stay creative.
I'm glad he's doing that.
And isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Oh, I had to mention that. And then the other biggest highlight, even though, I saw a Saints Row panel and Troy Baker said my name repeatedly because I asked him a question. That was a cool highlight. Do you know Troy Baker?
No.
He voiced like almost as many things as
other
person did all the voices. Whatever.
Famous voice actor guy.
Oh my God, why am I blanking on his name?
I don't know.
Are you talking
John
about
Benjamin?
No, the main game voice actor guy who's in everything.
Oh, he was like, that guy.
Male Shepard.
Yeah,
and,
that guy.
And
I know who you mean.
Anyway.
I don't know who you mean, but okay.
Whatever. And then
Nolan North.
Ah, okay.
And by the way, in Saints Row 4, there is like male number 1, male number 2, male number 3, female number 1, female number 2, female number 3, or Nolan North as your voice choices.
Nice.
And you can choose your avatar to like just be Nolan North.
Awesome.
Anyway, then I saw a panel with all the Children's Hospital and NTSF SDSUV guys, and that was rad.
I'm impressed that you rattled off that acronym. That was good.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
All right, we can move on.
All right. Well, thank you for that Comic-Con update, Josh. Let's do some board games.
Before board games, one other thing. Oh. I remember there was a piece of news.
All right.
Because we've covered crowdfunding and that kind of stuff, Ubuntu, in order to produce their, so they have like a phone OS coming out, have a $32 million crowdfunding effort happening on Indiegogo right now, which at the moment is, I just checked, it's at like $6.8 million.
Is that the biggest one ever?
The biggest one I'm aware of. I just thought it was interesting. So they want to They have said, so this is to build the Ubuntu Edge, which will be their like flagship phone to launch their new OS with, which is like crazy specs that seem off the charts, like 128 gigs of storage. It's so you can buy it essentially unlocked LTE for like between $700 and $800, depending on the level of the Kickstarter that you fund. And it seems like it's going to be like really on par with all the other stuff. This phone is able to dual boot their new Ubuntu phone OS and Android, which seems interesting. So I don't know to what extent you'll be able to like share contacts between the two OSs, but it seems pretty cool. And then it also has a dock that can dock it and turn it into a desktop Ubuntu experience. So it seems kind of bitchin', although that OS has, you know, yet to be seen. But I just thought it was interesting.
The specs of the hardware sound like next year specs. They're impressive. Yeah. The visual design and you know, physical design of the hardware looks and sounds rad.
Looks good, but it's
it looks really
renders.
Good. But yeah, they're like renders.
Yeah.
The value is so ambitious that it's like hard to see them. They're going to hit 32 million and yeah. be successful at all.
Yeah. But there's 6 million like 4 days in or something.
And it's on a site that isn't Kickstarter, so I'm not sure if it works the same way, where if they don't meet it, they don't get any money.
I don't know how that works.
Yeah, and is Indiegogo also 30 days?
I don't know.
Okay. Because, I mean, I've heard of Indiegogo. I mean, they're kind of like the more indie. They're usually like indie film Kickstarter.
Right.
At least that's where I've heard them. So I've never heard of someone trying to create a phone OS using it.
$6.9 million with 25 days left. So Ubuntu is making the phone OS for sure.
Yeah, whether or not
they're going out to hardware partners to have them make things. But what everyone has realized, like since Apple and iOS, is like you have to also make a device as kind of like a reference design for how awesome your stuff can actually be, because you can't count on carriers and everybody else. They're always going to take like safe routes and produce like shitty, you know, droids and whatever. Right, you can never, like, you have to make a Nexus, you have to be Apple and make the phone yourself in order for it to be as awesome as possible. And then everyone will go like, hey, Asus, why isn't your shit as cool as it could be? And then you drag everyone up. So they're trying to crowdfund
the phone, not the OS.
The phone.
Okay.
So that their OS has the best chance of doing well.
Okay.
But the OS is happening, and it's, in fact, you could have downloaded the VM of it and run it just to try it out like a couple months ago. Like it's pretty ready.
Cool. So they're crowdfunding the U phone instead of the iPhone.
Yeah.
Basically.
It's very black.
Yeah.
All right, cool. All right, so how do we want to do closing news, opening up games?
I have a video game to talk about.
Opened up games, so let's yeah.
Any video games to talk about other than mine?
I will just mention that Shadowrun Returns is a Kickstarter game, and it actually did come out when they said it was going to come out July 25th, a few days ago. I have it. It's cool. Someone has already started on user content, because really the main thing about this game is it's really more of a toolkit than a fully featured. I mean, it has a one player 12-hour long campaign.
This is like isometric RPG.
It's an old school isometric turn-based strategy game. Like the old like Super Nintendo version that came out like 20 years ago.
Turn-based.
It's turn-based combat. Sorry, turn-based combat.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, you move in real time.
Okay, yeah.
But someone has already started on user content to reboot the Super Nintendo game in this game, like rebuilding the whole thing in this game, which is... And I've already played like an alpha version of like the first couple maps of it. So that's sweet. I can't wait to play that. It's a really cool game. The art is nice. If you like that type of game, you should play it. I got it for $15 because I kickstarted it, but I think you can buy it for like $17 or $18 on sale right now. So that's my news.
Nice.
What about you, Charles?
Also, briefly, I played a decent tower defense Android game that's been on iPhone for a long time called Kingdom Rush. It's probably not news to anybody, but I think it's actually one of the best ones I've tried in a while. And then I've been playing more of the F2P MMO Neverwinter, which I don't think is that good. But I'm playing it because I want to be playing FF14 that's not out yet. And it does a handful of things that nobody else does, which is baffling. Why, like, WoW and other MMOs haven't done this yet. It does the phone game, like, addictive type lessons. Like, if you log in every day, you get, like, this gem as long as you don't skip a day. And if you get 7 days in a row, you got, like, a free sweet-ass chest. or if you there's a companion phone or web app where you log in and you you tap on your dudes to like kick off more crafting activities, mm-hmm. like one of those dumb phone games where you know, you have to check in every 6 hours to just tell your dude to do stuff again, mm-hmm. in order to get more or whatever. Except when it's like a companion to this other game and character you actually spend time with and care about, but it's like a way to briefly check in remotely, it's way more addictive and interesting.
Because you feel like you're actually getting something out of it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it does several things that are really, really smart that other F2B or other MMOs I've tried haven't done. But other than that, the actual game isn't fabulous.
All right.
and WoW does have a companion, like Armory iPhone app that lets you do similar things like that.
As far as I know, that thing lets you look at your character and its gear, and it lets you do the auction house stuff.
Right.
I don't think it does anything besides auction and gear.
The auction, yeah, I'm not sure, but the auction house is kind of a huge component because people play the whole game just auctioning.
I know it's had the auction for a while.
And you can spend real money on it.
Right.
Actual dollars.
Right. I was just talking about the gamey outside disc.
No, that's right. Cool.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So I actually, there are two things, video games. There's this game called Barkley : Shut Up and Jam : Gaiden, and they have released and crowdfunded, there we go, a sequel, which is really only relevant for the title, which I will now
please
read.
Please read it, yes.
The magical realms of Tir Nanog, escape from Necron 7, - Revenge of Chulilanin, - the official game of the movie, - Chapter 2 of the Hoops Barkley Saga.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
And also their page for the crowdfunding thing is pretty brilliant.
The Kickstarter page is amazing. Their stretch goals are amazing. Like, the whole thing is super funny. My
favorite joke from that Kickstarter video is, like, this video is canon.
Yeah, that's the first line. That's the first line of the crowdfunding page. What you're about to read is canon. the game that I actually played is Rogue Legacy, which is... I don't know where it came from. I had not heard of it at all beforehand. I don't know... it's a company called Cellar Door Games. It's a roguelite, they call it. So it's, unlike, a roguelike where every playthrough is brand new and you just start over every time, famously unforgiving genre. This is sort of like generational. So every playthrough is actually,
Infinity Blade.
Yeah. Like Infinity Blade. Every playthrough you get the chance to choose from three of your children. So your hero plays through, and then once you die, you have three children who you pick one of the three and then keep going, and then you build out a family tree, and you can go back and look at all, hundred or thousands, eventually, I would assume, of the heroes that you've played as part of your playthrough. But it's really, really fun. It's just like a super solid action platformer. The castle is procedurally generated every time. So there's like a castle. If you exit the castle out of the top, there's a tower. Out of the right hand side, there's like a forest area, and down at the bottom, there's a dungeon, and they're kind of, progressively harder. It's like castle, forest, tower, dungeon is the order of, scaling enemies, randomly generated, really, really solid, great feeling play. Works great on my crappy little HTPC, and they have done so many smart things that give it that, like, one more game. You have you save money, so you get all the money that you earn, like your family gets the money that you earn from each playthrough in the castle, and then you can use that to upgrade your stats, which are passed on to your progeny or whatever, and then each of those, but each time you enter the guardian of the castle takes all of your money every time you go back in. So if you don't spend it while you're outside the castle, when you go in, you lose everything and you start over. So they kind of keep you from getting too much money by doing that. And they just have... So not only is the castle procedurally generated, but so are your player character choices. And so they just have 1,000, it's like one of those, like, come up with a fake name where it's choose one from column A, one from column B, one from column C. So there are classes, and it'll be like you have three choices, right, of heroes, and each hero was generated by passing through the system where it's like I choose one of the six different classes that are available, and it chooses one or none or more than one of any like all these different traits, and the traits can be totally not relevant to playstyle. They're just like you're bald, right, or you're gay, or whatever, right? It could be something totally irrelevant, or something that actually affects the playstyle. Like you feel no pain, which means that you can't actually see your health bar, right? So your health bar is just blank, or you have no pulse in your feet because of some rare congenital disease, which means that you won't set off spike traps when you walk over them, right? You can't see, you're colorblind, and so when you go through that next playthrough, everything's in black and white, right? So
that's funny that they do the genetic aspect of like every unique ability.
Cool. That's the legacy part of the rogue.
Yeah. So you choose your one of your three dudes, you run through the castle, you get some loot, you go back. And it's also really funny. Like the writing is quite good. There's not much writing, but the interactions that you have with the few characters that you can interact with are pretty funny. This is Celador is the game that did Don't Shit Your Pants,
which is a proud legacy.
Which is an amazing
for them.
I'm doing really good at that game.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I watched
the IRL.
I watched a Let's Play of that, which was hilarious. Because how could it not be?
So they have little references throughout to all their other games, one of which is Don't Shit Your Pants. I think that's their best known. But this is amazing. It's great. It's It's only on PC.
From the people who brought you Don't Shit Your Pants. Sorry.
Which is a bummer because I think it would be amazing actually on Vita. It would be amazing on Vita. It would like almost convince me to buy one probably. Wow. Or like buy a used one or something to play it because
steal one.
Yeah. It needs those super tight platforming controls that you can only get with a controller, but it'd be a perfect mobile game other than that.
Quite a few indies are porting to Vita like a year or two late at this point, but hopefully more of them will be a lot faster and sooner.
It's great. It's like $12. Must play.
Yeah, cool. I was sold as soon as I saw it. I just haven't tried it yet.
Cool. All right, so those are all the digital games. Are we about to enter the analog
cardboard
domain? John's sitting over there quietly and patiently.
I think
I'm space
waiting for
games.
His chance to explode.
I think we have way too many to get through, so I think we need to focus on bring up the ones that you really thought were rad and you want to talk about.
So should we just go around the horn and each choose one that we want to talk
do
about?
It. Yeah.
Okay. Well, John, since you haven't had a chance, pick one of the games that you brought that we played that you'd want to talk about. Or do you want time to think about it?
What was I think you guys should pick.
All right, you go last and then tell us one of your highlights.
Yeah, I'll pick one that I think
Josh, you start. Start with a game.
Okay, I'll start with the game that you guys didn't play on Friday that just John, Russ, and I played for Jesus like 6 hours on Friday.
Approximately, yeah.
This is one game. It's not like you played multiple games.
No.
And this doesn't include the hour and 15 minutes it took me to teach them the game.
Right.
And this is common. This is usually how long it takes to get through the game.
A little long. Not,
okay,
not
5 to 6 hours.
As noobs, we were going a little bit slow with our decision making, but it would only
so maybe
be down
if you're fast,
four
it's like
and
three
and a half.
And a half or four.
It's usually four about an hour 45 minutes a player.
Okay.
So yes.
Okay. All right. So what game are we
so
talking about?
It was called Through the Ages. There's a subtitle.
The story of civilization.
Okay, it's called Through the Ages.
Shut up and jam.
It's Through the Ages.
The Curse of Tir-na-nog - Cthulhu's farts.
I believe it's the highest rated game on Board Game Geek.
It is not. It's in the fourth or fifth.
Oh,
it's behind
it's really
Sorry
close.
And Monopoly.
It's really close.
It's really close. There's a few different ways
in
to
my
rate.
Opinion, it should
it's
be
behind
the highest
Chutes
rated.
And Ladders in Candyland.
One of the
You just
highest.
Can't beat those guys.
It's John's personal favorite, I believe. Yes. The game of all time or whatever.
Wow.
And I thought it was quite fun. It's an engine building game. You know, you're trying to increase your economy so you produce more in a couple different ways. You try to produce more culture every turn, and you try to produce more science every turn. But culture is just like victory points, but science is like consumed when you play tech cards, which are like building structures or buildings or tech things or whatever. I don't know if I'm going to use all the right terminology, but this is the gist. There's just a lot going on. It's like there's a lot to manage. You just have all kinds of shit everywhere. It's really fun. Like somehow the time just flew and all of a sudden 5 hours had passed and we were like, oh shit, look at the clock. like, how did that go by? And I guess we're almost done with the game. It just felt like a 1.5 hour game that was riveting, except 5 hours had passed while playing.
Right. So a fundamental... So going back a little bit, just to describe how the game actually works, it's essentially a civilization building game, which is a large genre in board gaming and video games. In fact, most of the video games come from board games of this genre that came from like 50 years ago.
It's like the 4X genre?
It comes from that, yes. Okay, yeah. So the big thing about Through the Ages is that it's much more abstract than your standard civilization game. You think civilization, you think, okay, you know, I start with a little city, and then I make settlers, and I get two cities, and now I make a couple armies, and now I have a metropolis, and oh, I fight this, oh, I gotten so big, I fight the guy next to me. None of that is in this game. This game is purely abstracted. There is no board. There's no map. There is no, you know, water spaces, forest spaces, or anything. None of that. Your player area is just a little cardboard player mat in front of you that shows you all the details of your civilization via cards. This is a purely card game. You open up the box, it's just got a few hundred cards in it, and there is a board, but it's just for laying cards out on and showing the status, like Josh was saying, how much culture or how much science you have. So that means that, you know, when you attack somebody, it's purely abstracted. You have a value of strength, and you go against your opponent's civilization that has a value of strength. There are no actual tactics of units. You never move your archers into the right flank or anything like that. It's just much more abstract. The way I like to simplify it, essentially saying, most Civ games are macro management. You are on a very large scale. You're moving your armies. You're doing all this kind of stuff. Through the Ages is micromanagement, the civilization game. Every single turn, you are actually making sure you're moving food from one spot to another. You're trying to make your mines more efficient. You're micromanaging every little part of your little civilization, and you're trying to do that better than the other two people. And in a way, the military strength combat is just a check against someone who is over-prioritizing their economy. Most people don't follow competitive StarCraft. I know Charles does. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, I see it as an analog where essentially players can choose to do different things. They can choose to go military, or they can choose to go economy, and they are checks and balances on each other. So if I go economy and Josh goes economy, and Josh is doing better at economy than I am, it would be a fool's errand for me to continue doing economy because Josh is doing better than me. Josh will win. That doesn't make sense. So I should switch gears, go into military, and try and attack Josh and make him pay for his being so greedy. And likewise, if I go military and I don't do much with that military use, I'm wasting all that resources. And so I think it's very interesting how the checks and balances work in play. And in the game, I feel one of the players, I'm going to stay anonymous, built a lot of military and didn't do anything with it and ended up not doing very well at all because they put all these resources into making a bunch of enemies. The other two people were scared, but then we got less scared. Oh, I just admitted I wasn't one of those people. And I likewise went really greedy the moment I realized I wasn't actually getting attacked, and I end up almost doubling your guys' score. But I've also played this game 16 times, so I had a fundamental knowledge of the cards. Anyway, so that's I tried to make that as simple as possible to describe how it's different from most Civ games.
I was just wondering, so have you played other games that are like this but are on more macro and have a board? And
yes.
And you like those less?
I like them less.
And what about you, Josh? Do you also like the micro better than the macro?
I don't know if I would even call it micro rather than macro. I mean, I see that point. I would call it more like instead of being the military commander, you're like the COO. You know, you're only in charge of your infrastructure and like business decisions.
You're like the city planner
of your empire. Yeah, you know,
you're
and then
Patton,
when it comes to fighting wars, you just quickly determine that without even looking at the map. Like that's somebody else's responsibility. It's not part of the game. It's like way oversimplified for what you actually do for that component in the game. You know, it removes the whole map, removes all your military units. It's just, you're like behind the scenes just building your, it's just the extreme engine building mechanic. Just, you know, decide where to put your resources, where to focus on, what to build, and what, you know, and it's cool. Super interesting because I love engine building games. Yeah. So
that's actually a great analogy. That is better than mine. It, to a certain degree, you're the operating officer. You're saying, well, I built a bunch of archers and a bunch of cavalrymen, and then they went off to war.
It's like
away they went. Fight, oh, cool, they win, won. Or okay, oh, okay, they lost.
Yeah, but you
it's not my problem. Yeah, I made them.
Disconnect between the commander actually.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy.
Making them do their stuff, yeah. And they come back. And
it's
you
like
get the report.
Okay, my military number is higher. Done. Next.
Yeah, right. And there's no randomness there. In fact, there's almost no randomness in this entire game.
So there's no dice rolls?
There's zero dice.
There's just random in which card you pull from a deck.
Yes, the only randomness comes from one deck.
Because you don't know which card you're going to get.
Except, he says, basically every card in the deck comes out every game.
But you may not get the one you want.
It's not like you're pulling them randomly and look at it. You put them down face up to be available for purchase.
And then you purchase them.
Oh. So I mean, the only randomness
so they're for
there...
Auction, then?
You spend action points to take them on your turn.
So the only randomness is that out of the 10 out there,
mm-hmm.
you know, the two that are new after my turn when it's somebody else's turn, those two, somebody else gets the first chance at getting.
Right.
By the time it gets around to my turn, if I really want those, they're probably still there. Yeah. Because they're less expensive now, three turns later.
I'm not going to go into the specifics of it, but there is a smaller side deck that you can get military cards in. That one is random. You draw from the top, and that is, but those can be swinging. But by and large, this is a 90% non-randomness game. Very low on the random.
But as a first player, first time player, it was pretty random because I had never seen any of the cards before.
Right. Yeah.
I didn't know what was going to happen at the end of the game. So like every card looked like a random card to me, whereas he knows every card. So he knew exactly how much crazier shit's going to get
He knew how to value each card, and you had no idea what
three
his value
ages
was.
In. So I was focusing on victory points early in the game, and I was like way ahead and thinking I was doing well. And then all of a sudden, everything multiplied by like 5, and so my lead was negligible.
It evaporated
in the end
about
game.
2 turns, yeah.
Anyway.
Nice.
Really great. I'd love to play it again, except it's quite a time commitment to play.
I will bring it every time I come down.
all right, Charles.
Yeah. So, the one that that we played, this is probably on the, this is on the other end of the complexity scale from Through the Ages. We played this yesterday, just the three of us, Josh, John, and I. It was called Guildhall, and I don't know. This game is really simple. It's only got five. I mean, it's got a deck of cards. There are only five different types of cards.
Six.
Six different types of kind of character cards that you can play, but they're of there are five different colors. You get these characters. They each make a different set. The kind of it's set. The motif is medieval guilds. So there's like weavers and dancers and assassins and I don't know other ones, historians. So there's each one of those has a different skill or a different action that it takes. And then depending on how many of them that type of character you have in your guild hall, their actions have multiplying effects. It's very, very simple. You get two actions per turn, which means you can play, two of those, or you can play one and draw back up to five. And it's just a super simple set of rules that give rise to a really immediately engaging and fun game. We only played it once, and so I had a great time. I don't know if it would get boring after many repeated playthroughs, but it's just like very simple and very fun and cool.
I found that it has not gotten boring for me after repeated playthroughs. I heard about it. I thought I'd like it. I actually picked it up at a live board game auction, which was pretty sweet. Yeah, it has. There's a like Charles was saying. There's only six different types, but they interact so well. You know, the assassin kills a card. Well, the historian pulls a card from the dead pile back in your thing. So you could play an assassin to kill your opponent's card and then play a historian and then take that card from the grave and put it in your... There's just lots of ways.
So everything has a check and a balance against it, essentially?
Essentially, yeah. And the way I describe it briefly is it's a set collection game with a minor amount of engine building. So as you're making your sets, the end goals, you want to get one of each color in each role and then you can flip it over its currency for victory points. But the more of that role you play, so, you know, you just have a yellow farmer, he's kind of weak. You get a red farmer, now you have two. They're still kind of weak. You get a blue farmer, now you have three. Now they're stronger. So you get a little engine building process going where the more you have played, the more powerful their role, their action is. But on the flip side, you can't play a card of a color you already have. So the more you've played, the less likely you're going to be able to play that role more, because the less cards in the deck are legal to play. Until you get to five, you flip them over, and now it's back to brand new. You can play any color farmer you want. So it has...
It's kind of fundamentally balanced in that way.
Yeah, it really is. There was one point where I played up to four of a farmer, for instance, and I was not worried because both Charles and Josh had four assassins already, which meant that it was really unlikely they would happen to have the last correct assassin to play to hurt me. So I felt somewhat safe. Even though they were doing well, they had four assassins. That's good. That's close to being lots of victory points. I looked at the situation and decided I was somewhat safe in that situation. And I ended up going around. I got in. I played my fifth farmer and I got points. And really,
it's
really cool game.
Certainly a strange balancing mechanic, because like kind of the better you feel you're doing and the stronger the abilities of each guy are, the more likely you are to get a shitty hand that's useless with no cards you can play.
Your options reduce as you do better until you do so well that you're back to zero. Yeah. You have maximum options but limited power.
So I had like a ton of cards out, like four deep in Historian, right? Which means if I found the right color Historian, then it would be uber, right? Except I was sitting there with like no available good moves, but with like a huge pile of cards in front of me that looked awesome and powerful, except I was getting no points because I just wasn't drawing the right things. So I didn't have as fabulous experiences as Charles on his first play, but you know, I was learning some of the strategies, and you know, a few more plays it might be.
Yeah.
What I liked about this game in particular is that when John comes down, we all learn like 400 new games.
Yeah.
And we play a bunch of new games. And this was one where you can sit down, explain it in like 20 minutes, grasp basically the whole thing, and maybe not the highest level subtleties, but enough to really feel like you have a good handle on it as you're playing, which is, I think, in contrast to these much more complex games, which we only play when John is here and we play one time and it's like, this is the first time I ever played it, so I didn't do great, and I had no idea what the fuck was happening, and I totally screwed myself at the beginning because I didn't realize that this would be important later, and you know, it wasn't that kind of an experience, so I thought it was fun. Yeah.
Cool.
All right, so I'm going to talk about a game, although just a quick side note, one of the very short micro games we played that John brought was called Love Letter.
Yes, we played that too.
This card game with only 16 cards per round, or at all. And it was it was even better than that, where, you know, he explained it in like a minute.
Yeah.
And we all kind of got it. And then you could immediately start playing, and you started to get, you know, some slight strategy in it. And you can play like a round in like a couple minutes. So it was just a quick pick up a game, a quick understand. And we quickly played like six rounds of it in like, you know, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So that's a cool little palate cleanser.
I think you said that one was like $5 on Amazon.
It was $5.93.
And remember, it comes in a sweet ass velvet bag.
It says Love Letter. Yeah.
Which wow. John told me,
wow.
Which John told me offline actually, you know, led to some random people on a street when he was walking around,
yeah,
like come up to him and say, "Oh my God, Love Letter." Like,
are you
like,
going to a board game?
Are you going to a board game?
Because I was holding this little red felt bag.
Yeah. So it will totally get you noticed on the street if you carry that around.
Yeah. Only in Berkeley.
So the game that I wanted to mention that John and Josh and I played with Russ, but not Charles, was Hanabi. And please say this word because I'm not going to know it, but it won like basically the Academy Award of board games last year, which is called the
Spiel des Jahres. It means Game of the Year in German.
Right. So so this is of all board games available.
Yes.
Was the number one game.
Yes. This particular award usually aims towards family-friendly games.
Yes, which I would say it is.
Which is an asterisk. But yes, it covers the whole genre, essentially all family-friendly games for the whole year.
But newly released that year.
Yes, which is a controversial topic.
Oh, really? So it's only... Oh, well, but that's how the Academy Awards, right?
Right,
work.
Yeah.
Right,
for the year.
But it's just tough for board games because the biggest board gaming convention of the year where most games are launched is in Essen, Germany, in November. So they release them in November, and then it gets into everyone's hands in February, March, and then everyone's really confused. What year is this supposed to be released in? I don't know. So anyway, that's kind of a side thing that's only interesting if you follow board games like I do.
So Hanabi is a very interesting game that's unlike any other that I played in that it is totally co-op. So we played with four players, but you can play with how many, John?
It goes up to five. Yeah,
five. Goes up to five. So we played with four, and it's totally co-op. So it's not competitive. You're not trying to beat any of the other players. You're actually all trying to work together to win and essentially get a high score. And it's a card game with one interesting gimmick in that you can't see your own hand. So you get we all got a hand of four cards, and you hold it away from you. So everybody else can see your hand, but not you. So it's sort of like that old party game where, you know, you take one card and you put it up against your forehead and you get other people to try to guess what it or get you to guess what it is. And then the goal is or you have four different colors and five different colors. And each of them go from one to five, except the distribution is you have like 3 1s, 2 2s, 2 3s, 2 4s and 1 5. And the idea is to put them into stacks in the middle from one to five of each color or suit, if you wanted to use old terminology. You know, you can't put a two down and then put a one on top of it. You have to go in order. And the gameplay is each person on their turn, they can do one of three things. They can either play a card, they can discard a card, or they can do a hint. And if you discard a card, you get a hint. There's eight hints total that you start with. And so once you use them all, the only way you can get another one is to discard a card. And the hint that you can give any other player is you can either you can tell them one of two things about their cards. You can either tell them a value of a card, and if any cards share that value, you have to tell all of them. So you could say, like, these cards are a one. You can't just say this card is a one and not say that the other one is a one. Or you can say this card is a certain color. So you can say, like, these cards are blue, or these card or this card is a one. And that's essentially how you go around building up hints, and everybody tries to remember what they've been told about their card so that they can then intelligently play the right card. Now, if they play a card and it's invalid, it's you know you can't actually do that, then you get like a screw-up token. And it, once you do that three times, then the whole game is over. So the idea is to avoid that and actually build up these stacks of cards. So it's very social. You know, every turn, you know, it's you're kind of hedging your bets. Like I can help out my partner by telling them this, or you know I know this card is good based on what I've been told, so I'm gonna play it. Or no one in my case, I was getting like almost no hints the entire game, so I knew very little about my cards, so I discarded a lot of cards, and sometimes I discarded correctly, meaning it was not useful, or I discarded useful cards that I could have done but I didn't know anything about them. So I mean, it's definitely, you know, not nearly as like complicated as something like Through the Ages. Pretty simple rules, but it was just a unique experience. Like, it was unlike any other game I played, and it definitely family friendly. I could see why it won an award. I definitely want to play it again, because the one interesting thing is it's really, really hard, because you're supposed to play it with a poker hand. You know, you're not
poker face.
Sorry. Yeah. if someone like says like, I definitely think this card is a three. And you're looking at that card and it's a four, you really are not supposed to like make any reaction and say like, oh, you know, no,
which
you're
is
wrong.
Hard because you're all cooperative.
Right.
We're all cooperative and we're all human beings. Yeah. And it's really hard to just be totally, you know, like stoic about it.
Right.
So we definitely did that a lot and it felt a little cheaty.
Yeah. But well, there was an amazing moment where I knew one of my cards was a two. And then Mike told me a hint that two of my cards were fives. So I was not.
He even pushed them aside.
Pulled the fives over to kind of delineate. So I had two fives, and a single two. And then Mike took his turn, and then Russ took his turn. At which point, I had completely forgotten which one of those three cards was the two.
And we were all like, ah!
And I remember I was sitting there, and I just, you know, I. It's like when you meet somebody, and you're like, oh hi, my name's John, and they say, oh hi, my name's right in one ear and out the other.
Yeah.
And then 10 seconds later, you're like, oh my God, I have no idea what his name is. I did the same thing with you. I was not paying enough attention at that moment. And so I'm sitting there with these three cards and I say, all right, I'm pretty sure that this card, pointing to one card, is the two. And and then these two are fives, and everyone else just burst into hysterical laughter, and it was funny. It was amazing. I could not infer from them, from them laughing. All I was inferring was they were laughing at my idiocy that I had completely forgotten already 15 seconds later. And as it stands, I was wrong. I was pointing towards a card saying, I really think this is a two, and I was pointing to a five. And it's just a very interesting group think situation. Yeah.
I'm not sure I would put it as like my favorite game of all time, but it's definitely unique. Just mm-hmm. I've never played a game that was totally co-op like that.
Yeah.
So it gets points just for that, and it's fun. You know, it's fun to just. I don't know. What did you think, Josh?
Yeah, it had a lot of dynamics that were unusual, that were interesting and fun, and I could easily see a lot more games in that genre trying new things. So
yeah,
certainly fun.
Cool. I have two things I want to add to that really quickly. The first thing is. The reason you haven't seen very many co-ops, or this is the first co-op, fully cooperative game you've played, is mostly because I don't like co-ops in general.
Ah.
There is a massive genre for co-ops. It's incredibly popular.
Yeah. Now, why don't you like
them? I've played, what's the, is it called like Contagion or Outbreak?
Pandemic.
Pandemic, yeah.
It was part of the reason it's such a huge genre. Pandemic came out and it was massive to the board gaming industry. And yeah, that's a fully cooperative game.
All players are the world scientists attempting to stop a global disease, which continues to spread across
the world. There are five diseases spreading across the world. If you don't win, then the humanity is erased. Anyway, so that's one reason you haven't seen them, and I'll make a mental note, and I'll see if I can bring some more next time.
I'm curious, though, but
why if you like them.
Yeah, John just likes to win. He likes to crush people.
Yeah. I mean, I can totally understand most board games are competitive. Most games are competitive, so it's kind of in its own little niche.
Yes.
But, I mean, is that the only reason why you don't like it? Because, why would you bring this one at all unless it was just because it was an award winner?
That's a great question. The main reason I dislike almost every cooperative game is because almost every cooperative game lends itself to alpha player syndrome, is what we call it, where one player takes control of the game. You can totally do this in Pandemic, for instance, where there's these five diseases spreading across the planet, and one person says, "No, Sally, you need to go to Paris. Spend two actions getting rid of these two, because next turn, Rob is going to go to London, and he's going to do this, because right after that, Jim is going to go to Prague," and one person, and they're not wrong. That's the problem. Usually, this person gets the game better than everyone else, and they just command everyone to do, and usually everyone does what they say because what they're saying is right. What they're saying is correct, and suddenly you have one person playing the game, and everyone else is kind of just participating. They're spectating almost with a hand of cards.
It's the group project disorder that we all went through in school a game.
So it sounds like the easy fix for your issue with a lot of co-ops is to just give asymmetry to player knowledge.
Which is a Hanabi in a nutshell.
If every player knows something that everyone else doesn't and they're not allowed to tell them, then one player can't make the best decision for everyone. It's just impossible.
Hanabi
is really good at
is
that.
The best game I've bumped into that
but it seems
mitigates
like,
this alpha player syndrome.
But it seems like there's a way to just add that knowledge asymmetry to any number of co-op games.
You'd think.
Without as dramatically changing them.
It's pretty rare.
Yeah, I don't know.
Is that the common wisdom about co-op games, like in the gaming community, or is that just...
What do you mean by wisdom?
Your issue with it. Is that how most people feel, you think, or is that just you?
I don't think that because it's such a hugely popular genre.
So it's a hugely popular, even though that happens a lot?
Yeah.
Or you just...
Yeah.
The point is that it can, that can lead it to be.
If you happen to be in a group with no one who does this, then good on you. But there's always one.
I mean,
there's always one person who does it. It might even be me. If no one was doing it in a game where alpha player syndrome was possible, I could totally see myself accidentally becoming that player.
Yeah, especially if there's one person who's teaching the game to everybody.
Yeah.
Else.
Yeah. And it's usually the person who has the most knowledge. Mm-hmm.
If you are learning the game together, or if you don't have someone who's like, I don't know, way smarter or more strategic than everyone else, or if it's more balanced, then maybe other people don't have that problem in their group. As an example, I would say that Portal 2 co-op with Charles could fall into that type of problem co-op game where if one person were amazing at Portal and the other person weren't, and you were playing co-op Portal 2 levels together, one person would just tell the other one what to do the whole time, and the other one would just be following their directions to solve every puzzle. But because we were experiencing it for the first time, we had similar experience with Portal, and we were similarly skilled, we were kind of taking turns being the first one to figure out any given puzzle. And so, you know, for one specific door opening, I might tell Charles what to do, and then for the very next thing, he might tell me what to do because he figured that out first. So it just felt more fair and cooperative, and we didn't really have a negative experience. But I feel like it could have easily fallen into that trap.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't have any, like, hidden knowledge or anything to prevent that.
Hell, pretty much, like, any game. But especially, I remember watching Matt play Portal for the first time, and it was a big group of us over at Eric's house, and he was playing it. And I think a lot of us felt the backseat driver disorder rising up, and you just have to you have to stifle it because you're like, I know what to do. Why aren't you doing it?
Yep. The alpha player lives in all of us to a certain extent. And usually someone rises up to that.
Well, yeah. So you should definitely bring more games that are co-op that are like Hanabi that have made the fix, the asymmetrical knowledge thing, if that exists.
I will. I'll see what I can do. Fun. It's pretty rare for to have that.
Have your people contact our people.
I mean, you should make those games.
We're also a relatively well. Like, I think that the asymmetry, or rather the alpha player thing, can be true if that person is not a skilled communicator. And if they just say, like, you do this, you do this, you do this. Like, look, that's just the best way to do it, all right? Shut up and trust me, kind of thing. As opposed to, like, you do this because, right, this is why, here are the other options, but I don't think that's a good idea. This is why I think we should do this.
So there's room for argument.
So that there's a debate and there's an explanation and everybody learns, and then, you know, the game gets more fun.
And that's fine too, but I think there's also people, and I might include myself in that group, that want to figure it out. And if you're constantly being read the options by someone, you feel like you're not actually playing. You're still spectating.
Yeah.
Like you want to feel accomplished, and the only way to do that is for you to figure it out. The problem is, with any game, differing skill levels. Like, if I play a board game with John, no matter what, he's always going to figure out strategies before me. And so I'm always going to feel like I'm not actually playing it. I'm watching John watch me play. and that's fine, because I go into it knowing that, but you know, you can see how that power dynamic could always be an issue if skill levels are different.
So I mean, theoretically with there should be, you want to have that debate, and you want to have the kind of discussion where everyone's figuring it out on their own, right?
But a lot of that comes with just multiple plays and experience.
Right. And that's the problem. We're almost always playing it for the first time, so there's always that power dynamic issue.
Which segues into like the other three games we played yesterday that I'm having a trouble deciding which one to talk about. All three of them I felt like had a level of complexity that I didn't fully get, like the strategy. I was just making too many mistakes until late game, and as soon as we play a second instance of any of these three, I think I would do a lot better and like it a lot more. You know, it just took me making mistakes to figure out, you know, what I did wrong, or to learn like a good strategy for the games. The three I'm mentioning are Zulkin, Nexus Ops, and Uchronia. But I guess the one I'll focus on, I'll just mention briefly that I think Uchronia is brilliant, and it is also like a distilled engine building game where there's almost nothing, there's no like board to the game, there's almost nothing to do except just build your engine, increase your economy and your activity power, and then build buildings in front of you. And John said it was essentially a distillation of some other huge, more epic game.
It's a streamlined version of a game called Glory to Rome that was made by the same designer. So the same designer made both of these. Glory to Rome was a huge hit, but it's one of the hardest games I've ever bumped into to teach. Not because it takes forever, but because it's just
complex.
It's so complex that I have trouble even teaching it, and then once I'm done teaching it, I look at everyone who just learned it, and they all look like I was speaking in Chinese every single time I've taught this game. So he, and I think he got a lot of criticism for that, even though Glory to Rome is brilliant, and so he took it to himself for the game he made, and he streamlined it, made it, it's not just a retheme. He streamlined it quite a bit. It changed it around and made this new game that I think is far superior.
Now, the strange thing about that game is, like, it took me almost the whole playthrough to figure out all the good things I should be doing that I didn't start doing until late game or whatever. But then I almost immediately felt like Charles, which is that I'm not sure how many more playthroughs I could do of this before I thought I was doing the same strategy every time. Mm-hmm. and just like repeating it.
Right.
It would definitely be fun to play one or two more times. And
yeah,
then
for sure.
I'm totally not sure about playing five or six more times.
I think that game is really good. If I had a criticism, I would say that the theme is a little confused. Like it's like dinosaur Romans.
It's dinosaurs and humans living together in a kind of a weird...
It's like Land of the Lost.
Almost ancient Rome.
Yeah.
It's very... It's a little confused and
But it
funky,
almost looks like post-apocalyptic because it's like ruins covered in ivy.
Yeah.
It's very confused.
It's not the greatest of themes, but the mechanics are pretty solid. Yeah.
But the other one I have to mention in more detail, because I'm sure Charles would want to bring it up, is Zulkin, which had an amazing board... Full of fucking Aztec gears, like turning each other. Did you play this already?
No, but John showed me the gears, and I was like, "Yeah, man,
yeah,
that is a good idea."
So these are actual plastic gears, five of them. One main one, no, six of them. One large main one, and then five smaller ones stuck to the sides. And you spin the middle one, and all five on the outside.
More and games then, need, yeah, like Mousetrap. Like, that was the best game ever, because it had a bunch of cool moving
right,
parts.
Right.
Yeah. But besides the gears, just putting your, like, pile of corn pieces in the middle of the large gear just felt so right, you know? And then putting little pieces of corn on the gears while they turn, and then each of the five outer gears is, like, almost like an orbital station in Alien Frontiers, where you just choose which place you want to put your dudes to try to, like... perform activities or gain resources or whatever.
Right. The genre for this game is worker placement, just like
worker
Alien Frontier.
Placement.
So that's why you get that
that's
same
what you
vibe.
So it was really fun. The art was really cool. There were a lot of things, choices of what to do though, and I had a hard time deciding what to do when the brutal like tax of feeding your people corn every few turns felt like it was all consuming. You know, if you could find a way to at least meet that like difficult barrier to entry, then you could actually have a chance to perform some additional strategy and actually try to win.
Like but, actually getting points.
Yeah.
Because you don't get points for feeding your people. You just have to do it.
so you're saying that mechanic is a little wearisome?
It was particularly harsh.
Streamlined or
it was
something.
Particularly harsh because we were advancing the wheel two at a time, like way more than usual. Apparently,
it's a side thing that you can do in the game.
It's like there's only 26 moves in the game,
right?
Yeah,
and you have the option of essentially each player can move the wheel twice on a turn instead of once. Mm-hmm. So in a four player game, hypothetically, it could only be 22 turns, and in standard play with the people I'm used to playing with. Maybe it gets double turned once. Mm. And right from the get-go, the moment Josh, Martin, and Charles all had even the option of moving it twice. They all did it.
I want to turn that big gear twice. That's awesome.
And I never did, and they made fun of me every time. I could have. Like, why aren't you moving it twice? Moving it twice is awesome.
Yeah, because you get to touch the gear more.
But also...
Why wouldn't I do that? Of course I'm doing that.
Also, the other strange thing about that game is that your worker places... are almost invariably like planning for several turns later to do something with that guy. So it's totally a long
not only that
long
is
game. I mean it's the long-term strategy.
Yeah, it's the chess mentality.
It's playing ahead, but not only that, you can only either place a worker or remove a worker and get the benefit of that, right? So like removing the worker is when you get the benefit of whatever it was doing and how long you invested in mm-hmm. in having it out there doing its work. You can only either place workers or pull workers in a turn. Mm-hmm. So your options for any given turn are very limited, and you just spend the whole game sitting there thinking about just planning out a million different scenarios. There are five different of these gears that some give you resources, some let you advance down a tech path, and there's this god track and all of it interrelates and trying to pick a strategy at the beginning is difficult, but you sort of have to specialize a little bit. And yeah, so I ended up getting stuck on the worker tax thing because there's a beginning stage of the game where there are buildings available that let you kind of really drastically reduce that food cost for additional workers. And so rather than going for that, I thought I would run lean on workers and have fewer number of workers. And then I basically spent the entire game just barely scraping by to amass enough food every six turns to pay for my guys.
And I basically
didn't have any other options and wasn't able to do anything
and
else.
And not having enough dudes either to even gather the food for themselves.
Yes. So that is a critical feature.
Yes. I want to clarify
real quick. Reduce food cost, dudes, if you play this game.
I want to clarify real quick why there are gears. We didn't actually explain that. There are gears.
Because they're awesome?
Right. Well, they are awesome. Oh. So when in a worker placement game, you like you said, you place workers and you can remove them. In this game, you have to put the worker at the beginning of the cheapest, leftmost, essentially, gear location. And then at the end of every turn, the big gear gets moved once. It has 26 teeth. It's going to move 26-ish times, depending on the double move. And so the idea of this game is the longer you leave your worker on a gear, the farther that worker will just travel. Because it stays on the gear, and the gear moves, and the gear moves. So it's almost like a game where you're constantly putting off, you're trying to put off, pleasure delayer? You're trying to put off as long as possible, pulling
delayed,
them off.
Because delayed gratification.
It is almost always better to leave them on longer. The longer they are on, it almost always, you will get more benefit.
You're investing time.
You're investing time. So having more workers means you can stall longer, and the workers you have will be able to get farther. Charles only had three workers. He was forced to pull twice as often as I was. I had five and Martin had six. We could stall longer and longer. We could put two workers out next turn, put two workers out next turn, put two workers out fourth turn later. We pull those first two that were gone three turns earlier, or maybe we only pull one of them. And we leave one of them to go in even farther. Whereas Charles would put two out, next turn put one out, and then the third turn have to already pull one of those two out that he just put two turns ago. They didn't go anywhere near as far, so yeah. It's just kind of
basically from not knowing the game well enough, not knowing what was important. Yeah.
I probably should have advised you to get another worker.
It's the first play. Right?
Yeah, that's true.
This is what happens. John.
Yeah.
Okay, so you mentioned two games. You want to mention another game, Charles?
We can talk about Nexus Ops. I think Josh was about to mention it, but
I just want to say the best part about Nexus Ops was these little alien plastic units
component
are so
quality.
Rad.
Yeah.
Like, the game's all right, but the components are so fun.
So the build quality is high.
I just want to play other games with those units. I want to bring those games into the Aztec age and put them on the gears.
They're amazing. Like,
I don't know.
They're
man.
Really, really cool.
Just play Risk with all these little
alien
guys.
They're little translucent. They almost look like jelly. They look edible. They're translucent.
They look like a gummy
colors.
Bear. Aliens.
Yeah, they're neon. Apparently, if you hit them with a black light, they glow, which is awesome.
Oh my god, we need a black light.
I think I've seen photos on Board Game Geek of that.
Wow.
And yeah, they just little sculpts. And so unlike it's kind of a. Well, I don't want to take over.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a war game. You make units and you fight opponents. Make units, fight opponents, and there's six different units. And they could have gone really boring and had like infantry, tanks,
right,
planes, but they said no, we want the weakest unit in the game to be a human, and then we want fungus beasts and crystalline golems,
fucking
and now
dragonfly.
A massive spider with another human riding on it. How about a massive lava breathing lizard with a human riding on it? You know what, let's make a gigantic dragonfly that
and they're like
plasma,
beautifully modeled, like awesome.
So they're just
the gameplay though is almost identical to Risk or Axis and Allies or something, except oversimplified combat where it's fewer dice rolls that are easier to determine the winner, and then the board is all hexes and very tightly packed, so you have like almost no options of retreat, and you're almost forced to like attack everyone immediately.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then the game doesn't end like 6 hours later with a full takeover of the board. It ends after a few turns after you get like a handful of victory points.
Yeah. It's a skirmish game. You get victory points for winning battles, essentially. Yeah. For the most part, winning battles, not winning wars.
Yeah, totally.
That being said, Martin ended up winning by essentially winning the war by completely eradicating Josh.
It was brutal.
But that's not necessarily how you win. The slow and steady usually does better than the Blitzkrieg.
I rolled a lot of ones.
You did. You did not roll very well. You should work on your die rolling skills.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your random ability to make dice appear correctly is failing.
You would own it this game, Mike. You'd just be like, all sixes.
Yeah. 2 20s in a row. What the hell, man?
So it's a very cool game.
Yeah, it's cool. The component quality is cool. Hex board, kind of, it's got a fun, it also has another fun, like, on the board mechanic, which is like this tall, the middle hex is actually a tower. It's like a little built up tall tower, which is fun. Yeah, it's, the build quality is great. The gameplay is fun. It's hard. It was hard for me to move out of the mindset of, I happened to start with a very like resource rich distribution of tiles, and so I really spent a lot of time like just building up a huge army to protect that.
You just turtled, yeah.
And the value, like, I had a huge army value, but it wasn't actually generating much victory point value. Yeah. So
that would be, that would have obviously been the strongest strategy if it were last man standing war.
Right. Yeah.
But it wasn't. It was like go win skirmishes immediately.
Right. I almost won with far, far less resources and far, far less army value as a whole for the whole game.
Yeah.
I ended up not winning. Martin ended up winning with the opposite approach. He just had a gigantic army. He waited and waited and waited and then did a blitzkrieg and won. But it was close. My both strategies were viable, which I love.
Martin's strategy was only viable because I basically rolled over and rolled an infinite number of ones.
Yes, blame the dice.
It's Nexus Ops, much like Zulkin, is one of those board games where if you were playing this at an event and someone walked by the table, they would stop in their tracks and say, "What the hell is that game? I want to play that."
Yeah.
Just from glancing at it.
Totally.
Through the Ages, which I mentioned earlier, no. People would just walk right by that game. They'd
both
just be like, okay, a bunch of cards, whatever.
Yeah, both those Nexus Ops and Zulkin, they are sold by looking at a screenshot on Board Game Geek.
Speaking of games that are sold by how they look, we have to at least talk about Rock Me Archimedes.
Okay, yeah.
So I'll just do a brief setup of how this game works, but I didn't actually play it, I just watched it. So Rock Me Archimedes, to me, looks like one of those games that you would buy at like one of those nature science-y stores in a mall, like a Discovery.
Totally looks like that.
Like, that's what that game looks like.
What was that one game that they always sold at those stores, which was like the hexagonal, is it Abalone?
I don't know. That they always sell.
It's like that hexagonal black and white ball pushing game.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah. So this game is basically, I mean, it has a Jenga quality, but I don't want to say that
it's Jengish.
I don't want to say that as it represents it. But basically, you have a board. You have like a flat board, and it has a bunch of little notches in it that you can put discs. And
marbles.
And it's on a
marbles.
Or marble. Sorry, it's on a semicircle.
A hemisphere.
Yeah,
on the
so it's like a seesaw.
It's a teeter totter.
It's a seesaw.
Yeah. It's a seesaw. Yeah. A teeter totter board, and you have black and white marbles. And your goal is to you first put them in the middle, and then you want to move them to your end zone, and you want to get four of your marbles in the end zone without making the teeter totter hit the ground.
Yep.
And of course, your opponent is trying to do the same thing. So it's kind of a game of a balance, physics. And depending on how you want to play dexterity, I don't know. Do we want to get into that argument officially?
We were just saying one statement briefly that it is valid to play the game in with multiple sets of house rules.
Agreed, yes. Yeah. The rules themselves have three printed variants. You read the rules and then it's variant one. Do it like this. Variant two, play it differently. Variant three, play it very differently. So yeah,
although those very rules, those rules make it vague onto what
you're supposed to
the
do.
The intended way
true.
To play it is. Yeah,
yeah
it is
you,
true.
You could play it more cerebrally with like infinite replays for mistakes to double check whether the physics would have tipped it. Or you could play it with more of a dexterity Jenga-like manner where you make a mistake, you tipped it, fuck you, you lose, you know?
Right, and unlike Jenga, which if you mess up because you're not dexterous, it's very difficult to put the board back the way it was. Whereas here, you just put the marble back on.
Yep.
Right. It's infinitely repeatable experiment, which I think is fascinating.
So it seemed really cool, although I'm definitely not good at holding my fingers and hands still and maneuvering precise things. So it's like one of those games that I think I would be bad at if you were playing the dexterous way.
Right.
I mean, I was watching Dave play yesterday, and he is also not good at the fine motor skills, which is weird because we're both guitarists.
Too much coffee.
I don't know. But, yeah,
there was too much pressure, I think. There was like five people.
There was a lot of pressure.
We were all watching.
Mike was clinging to a pillow and hiding behind Russ's shoulder on certain moves.
Well, there was,
like,
there was
really
one marble that Dave like had on the far end of the board that many times he like gestured towards, and we're all like, "Dude, physics!
Don't open the door!"
Yeah, and we're all being jerks
the whole time.
Super critical backseat drivers.
It was awesome,
which made it a lot more fun. Honestly, it was.
It was a much more like on TV, special
way more social
kind of
experience
game,
than I thought,
and it less like, methodical.
It felt like five or six people played a game that actually just Dave and myself played.
Yeah. It was pretty
cool. That's fun. That's fun. The, you know, Jenga has that quality too, where it's like the edge of your seat.
Don't screw up, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was really cool.
Don't pull that one.
And I just wanted to make a quick note. This is going to be complaining, and you can groan all you want, but so we played this card game that we'd played a long time ago that John brought called Our Echo,
yes,
which is actually a pretty neat, fun little light card game.
Like O-U-R?
No, like the letter R hyphen
E-C-O.
I thought you were going to say Bonanza.
It's supposed to be short for Recycle Ecology.
No, I like that game. That was cool.
Bonanza was more fun than Our Echo.
Yeah, Bonanza was cool, but Our Echo is...
Our Eco?
Yeah.
Yeah, or Our Eco, whatever. So it's like a card game with a recycling... motif, and it's pretty simple. You have four recycling centers, you put cards down, and you take what's there, but if you have four and you put down, then you pick up little chits that have victory points on them. We played it before with only three people.
Like 4 years ago.
Yeah, and it seemed balanced with three people.
Yes.
The problem with five people that I found is that, well, first, I definitely subscribe to the gaming philosophy of Sid Meier when he says that a game is a series of interesting choices.
Yeah.
The problem with our echo after about halfway through the game is that I was basically down to like one card every move, which is not an interesting choice because there's only one choice at that point, whereas everybody else had multiple cards and multiple choices. So for the latter half of the game, it was not fun because there was no choice to be made, and that seems like a pretty heavy imbalance of the game that could happen.
It definitely seemed like that game should not have had 2 to 5 players printed on the box.
Right.
And it's possible that the designer didn't even want to go to 5 players, but the publisher might have said, well, we'll sell more if we put 2 to 5 players on the box. So yeah,
are there other games that you find that to be true?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, Guildhall.
Yeah.
We talked about just earlier, that plays 2 to 4. And it functions okay at 4, but the added complexity slows the game down so much.
Yeah.
It does not add much. So I went into that game. I said, oh, cool. Martin had to go for an errand. This game is best with 3. Let's play this game with 3.
It's like the difference in complexity between balancing an RTS with 3 races or with 4 races, right?
There's a huge difference.
There's a massive increase in
complexity.
Yeah. For certain games. So I have the choice of assassinating someone, but I want to assassinate someone who's of a color that I don't also have. So I want to kill one of their stack of weavers, but I want it to be one that I don't also have, but maybe that my opponent does, so they're more likely to go try and steal it back from the other guy, right? Mm-hmm. And so when that's with 3 people, it's a relatively simple set of, you know, evaluations, and with 4 people, then it just gets drastically more complex.
Yep.
So
you can fall into a mental analysis process rabbit hole where just too many options, you can't pick one, and your brain just stalls.
So the kind of supports 2 to 4, but best with X is
opinion.
An interesting...
But back to your situation of having very few options, like you had one option almost every turn.
Mm-hmm.
When we were initially playing Uchronia, I felt like I was a little bit in that boat. Like I only had one or two options, like repeatedly, because I forgot about this critical rule that completely reversed that and like fixed the game so that you never have no good options.
Almost never, yeah.
Almost never, because all you do is if your hand is full of dupes of terrible cards, you just play a pair of cards you don't want.
Any pair.
And it becomes an individual...
Is a wild.
Wild.
Ah.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It just one mechanic completely made that game from like super annoying to like almost flawless. Like just...
Yeah, that's
like
true.
You never get stuck.
You
always
have
a good choice.
So was there a move in Our Eco that I just didn't know about that would affect my situation?
No, I think it played bad with 5.
Our Eco is just kind of broken.
I think
okay.
I think that game is best with 3.
Okay.
probably okay with four, but that was it was bad with five. I'm not going to play with five again.
Okay, enough said. Yeah. Were there any other games we wanted to talk about? I mean, we played other ones.
We've talked about every single one but Bonanza, I think.
We didn't talk about Shadowhunters.
We can talk about those if you'd like.
Bonanza is like a funner version of our eco. With more social interaction.
It has much more social, much more negotiation, and it involves actually helping your opponents to help yourself.
Yes.
Which is kind of neat.
And the theme's better. You're collecting cute little beans.
It's a really cool game. It's been a classic for a long time. It won the Spiel des Jahres the year it came out, I think. Crap, don't check that. I think it did, but I could be wrong. And it's just... We played games with a couple people a couple nights ago, and one of the people who came over, one of your friends named Lindsay, plays games, and she saw my massive stack of games that I brought, and she said, "Oh, the bean game."
Yeah.
So, you know, it has wide appeal. She recognized it. It's pretty pervasive.
A girl recognized it, listeners.
There are many females.
That's significant.
There are many women who play in my gaming group in the Bay Area, I'll have you know. Win more than the guys do.
I thought that was a reference to a male Lindsay.
No,
Mike was just being super sexist.
Yep. So, does anybody have any other games they wanted to talk about that we played?
Shadowhunters was like Mafia or something like that.
But with a board game.
Slightly more
to
board
it.
Gamey Mafia.
Yeah. It was pretty fun. I like those type of games. They're fun.
And random win conditions that can totally like abruptly end the game.
Yeah, that one is essentially a deduction game where you are given a hidden role at the beginning of the game. You have an ally, potentially. And you want to figure out who your ally is, there is a mechanic in the game to deduce small packets of information from people. And so the main game is, I will get a tiny bit of... So you can be one of three different types, shadow, hunter, or neutral. So I might get information from Mike that he is not a shadow, for instance. And then Mike gets information from Lindsay. I don't know what that information is, but suddenly Mike attacks Lindsay.
Mm-hmm.
And I am also not a shadow. So now I'm thinking, well, maybe I should attack Lindsay because there's a 1 in 2 chance that Mike is a hunter and I am a hunter. And then you see someone and then you see Lindsay attack. Then Lindsay gives information to Mike and then Lindsay does not attack Mike. And you're like, what? That's where the funness in that game is. And every character is different. They are far from balanced. It's a quick game. It's fun. It's deduction, lots of laughs, lots of swearing. The damage is a die roll, so you could roll dice, do no damage, roll the dice, do 5 damage, which is half of your life usually. So it toes the line of party game. It's like, am I a party game? Am I a board game?
And I'm not even sure that anybody even picked up a white card like the defensive pile.
No one did
about other people or the weapons.
Well, no one happened to roll that number. If someone had rolled
we often rolled the place where you can choose whichever you want, and no one ever chose a white card.
No, they didn't. Yeah. And that's pretty standard for playing that game. It happened. Well, the game also ended a little early because the person who won was Lindsay, who was one of the neutrals who does not have a teammate, and the neutrals have a custom win condition, and hers was that she die first.
Right.
So she essentially pissed everyone else off, attacking people like crazy to make them not like her.
That's hilarious.
She died. She flipped over her card. She won.
I didn't realize until John explained it to me that my card, which was also a neutral, had the win condition of be alive when the game is over. And so, I was alive when the game was over, so I also won because she went out.
Yes, nice. Yes.
And I was just like, what?
it's odd.
It was very weird.
It's a fun game.
Yeah. Since I guess we're naming every game we played, we also played Abandoned Ship, is you're a bunch of rats on a ship and you're trying to escape, but you don't want to be the first to escape because that actually gets you no victory points.
Well, no, so you're not a bunch of rats on a ship. There are a bunch of rats on a sinking Titanic-esque ship, and you care about 3 of them.
Oh, that's true.
But the 3 that you care about is hidden. No one else knows what that.
Right.
And then there's a die locking mechanic where you roll dice, and when you use a die, you pull it off, and the die can't be used until all the dice are used. And the main mechanic of that game is you have sort of allies. You win by yourself, but multiple people care about multiple rats. So if you want the purple rat to give you lots of points, odds are good 1 or 2 other people also want the purple rat to win.
It borrows a slight mechanic from Shadowhunters in that there is hidden information that can be useful for you and that you have to figure out through other behaviors.
Right. I could deduce, like, if Charles is the next person.
If he's constantly putting yellow up, he must have that color.
Right, and if I have yellow as well and I roll a good die for yellow and purple and I care about purple, I might do the purple one, assuming, hoping, that Charles will continue to help Yellow, which helps me. So you can kind of play that game. It's also a very light game with great component quality because you actually sink the ship. Like the ship sinks into the water. You pull it's a ship piece over a board piece, and you slide the ship down.
Although
the rats
are not very realistic.
They are made of wood.
And they're flat. And have no detail.
It's adorable.
How dare this $30 game not have sculpted minis?
I'm just saying,
minis.
You said build quality about Nexus Ops, which sounds incredibly detailed, and those rats were not incredibly
that's
detailed.
That's kidding. I thought it was adorable.
It's well, adorable, that's fine, the but build sink, quality, not necessarily
the
same.
Whole ship sinks slowly, and your
it's
little rats
game.
Are moving
and
up.
Plus, a great thing about that game is it plays seven players very well.
Wow.
Just, I would
that's
say,
true. It does.
Almost as well at four. Many games say they go to 6 and 7, and you're like, no, you never want to play that game at 6 or 7. This game, sure. Yeah, you can.
Same with
totally
Bonanza. That also was a 7.
Yes, same with Bonanza.
And played well with 7.
Yep. And that's the reason I bought it. It's because sometimes you want to play 7. We had 7, and you don't want it to drag. You don't want, if everyone has a 20 second turn in a 7 player game, then it's going to be some number of mathematical minutes until your next turn, whatever.
Right. And the reason why
downtime is bad.
Why those games work is that even when it's not your turn, the things that people are doing still affect you.
They're interesting. Yes.
Yeah. And you're either rooting or rooting against, right. And so that's interesting. Okay. So I think that's all the games we played so far. A quick thing on a game that hopefully we're going to play soon. That Chaz and Josh and I played previously is called The Perfect Heist, and we talked about it on the podcast, but mm-hmm. we're gonna hopefully play it with John and other people, so I'm looking forward to more people to see how the dynamic changes and just how other people play into that. Were there any other games that we're planning on playing? Anybody that you're looking forward to that you brought, or is it just we don't know and we're gonna go up and pick random ones?
We don't know. Perfect Heist. And maybe other stuff. Maybe we'll play a copy, maybe we won't.
Maybe Corporate America.
That'd be fun to play. I like that one. Cool thing, actually. Cool thing about Corporate America, which we have not played yet. I'm not going to go into the specifics of the game. It's you're all businesses trying. It's very tongue in cheek, goofy business names. You're trying to manipulate the political system to make you the most money. You can be the president.
Totally unlike real life.
Totally unlike real life. But the cool thing about that game is that was a Kickstarter game that was designed by a friend of mine.
Nice.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you linked it to me a while ago when the Kickstarter was actually going. Oh, okay.
Exactly, yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah, his name is Teal, and he has a company called Nothing Sacred Games. This is his first board game. And
so is he working on a new one now?
Working on lots. He actually took time off from, he quit his day job, and he's just working on being a board game designer, working on his company, which
is
pretty sweet. And I've played many of his prototypes, and he's a great guy, and he makes really cool games, and the component quality in this is excellent. He did a great job all the way through.
Just from seeing the box, it looks really well designed.
Yeah, and it's cool to say, I know Teal, he is my friend. Yeah. You know,
led on to me offline that you freaking have played several games of Dominion with the maker of Dominion.
That is true.
That's even more amazing.
That is pretty true, yes. Yeah. Donald X tests games in the Berkeley board gaming meetup group in Berkeley, man. So
have you ever beat you ever beat him at his game?
No.
Okay.
Well. He is very good at his games.
There you go. All right. Any other things that you guys want to discuss, or should we go play some board games?
Let's do it.
Okay. So this has been the Escort Mission. Thank you for listening. Go to our website, theescortmission.com, to check out all our shows. You can get us on the social medias. Make sure to click our Amazon link on our website and buy your stuff through it so we get a little...
Buy these board games if any of them sounded good.
Yeah,
almost
buy these board games.
All of them are on Amazon because
we can link
buy.
Everyone individually.
Yes, we will link every game.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
They're all worth playing. Check them out.
Especially Love Letter, which is $5.
And comes in a sweet-ass velvet bag!
Yeah.
All right, I guess we're out. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Cool.